for joining us. I'm Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report, sitting in for Diane Rehm. At 24 years old, Winston Churchill's career goals were crystal clear. He was going to be the Prime Minister of Great Britain. How to achieve that, however, was a bit of a question mark. He knew he had to make a name for himself, do something truly heroic. And that's how Churchill found himself in a POW camp in South Africa. Best-selling author Candace Millard tells the story of his capture in a new book, Hero of the Emperor, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill. Candace Millard joins us here in the studio. So glad to have you.
So happy
thank
to
you,
be here.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
For many folks who might not know much about Winston Churchill, maybe even if they do, I think this is a fascinating look into a portion of his life that we hadn't heard much about. And more specifically, I think when you look at the cover of this book, it talks about, you see the term Boer War, and you think maybe this is going to be a historical work about the war, but there's so much there that's about daring escape, and it feels like it reads more like a work of fiction in some places than nonfiction. So I think to capture that flavor, it would be great if you could just read a little bit of your prologue to set the stage of what we're going to learn about this man that we think we know so much about, and yet we didn't get to hear to read about it in this detail.
Absolutely. Crouching in darkness outside the prison fence in wartime Southern Africa, Winston Churchill could still hear the voices of the guards on the other side. Seizing his chance an hour earlier, the 25-year-old had scaled the high, corrugated iron paling that enclosed the prison yard. But now he was trapped in a new dilemma. He could not remain where he was. At any moment, he could be discovered and shot by the guards or by the soldiers who patrolled the dark surrounding streets of Pretoria, the capital of the enemy Boer Republic. Yet neither could he run. His hopes for survival depended on two other prisoners who were still inside the wall. In the long minute since he had dropped down into the darkness, they had not appeared. From the moment he had been taken as a prisoner of war, Churchill had dreamed of reclaiming his freedom, hatching scheme after scheme, each more elaborate than the last. In the end, however, the plan that had actually brought him over the fence was not his own. The two other English prisoners had plotted the escape and agreed only with great reluctance to bring him along. They also carried the provisions that were supposed to sustain all three of them as they tried to cross nearly 300 miles of enemy territory. Unable even to climb back into his hated captivity, Churchill found himself alone, hiding in the low, ragged shrubs that lined the fence, with no idea what to do next.
Thank you. That sets it up perfectly, and we're going to get into that story. But first, I think we need to take a step back. Mm-hmm. To talk about how did Winston Churchill get here and who he was at this point in his life. He's only 24 years old.
Right.
He comes to South Africa, not as a soldier, but as a reporter.
Right. So he was a young man who was burning with ambition. So although he's only 24 years old, this is his fourth war on three different continents. He's already written three books, including his first and only novel, Savrola, and he's run for parliament for the first time and lost. And so after that, he quit the military. He had thought that that would be his road to fame and then political power. He called it the glittering gateway to distinction. But it was too slow for him, and he was trying to find another way. But after his electoral defeat, he realized that he still needed to make a name for himself before he could win that political power he desired so much and that he thought was his destiny. So when the Boer War broke out in South Africa, he knew he had to be there, but he wasn't in the military anymore. And he had been making his living as a journalist. He didn't have any money, and he was an amazing writer. And so he'd already been writing for different newspapers. And so he got a position with the Morning Post, and he became the highest paid correspondent that England had ever had. So
And they had a bidding war over him,
yeah,
didn't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Go big or go home. That was his motto, and that got him to South Africa.
And it's interesting you point out he didn't have a lot of money, but he came from a position of great privilege.
Yes.
And there was so much in his life that seemed to be about making sure that not only he was respected and he had this ambition, but his father, of course, well known, and right. had his own setbacks, political setbacks. How much was this making up for the failings of his family?
It's hugely important in Winston Churchill's life. So he's a direct descendant of the first Duke of Marlborough, John Churchill. And John Churchill was given the land to build Blenheim Palace, which is this enormous, extraordinarily beautiful palace that was built in the early 1700s. And his father then was the third son of the seventh Duke. He was Chancellor of the Exchequer. He was a leader of the House of Commons. And Churchill admired him hugely and was so proud of him. But he didn't really have a close relationship with his father. His father was too busy and was really very, very hard on him. And that's something that Churchill regretted his whole life. And then his father died very young. He was 45, and a very public and tragic death. And Churchill thought that he, too, would die young. Mm. And he wanted to sort of make up for what had happened to his father and prove to everyone else that the Churchill name was synonymous with greatness and leadership.
And he had something of an I don't know if it's fair to call it strained, but his relationship with his mother, of course, American-born.
Right.
But she was a widow was she in her early 40s as well?
Yes.
And she had her own romanticist interests, and he was not always happy about that. So talk to us a little bit about his relationship with her.
So his mother, as you say, was American-born. She was this incredibly beautiful socialite born Jenny Jerome, and she was sort of the talk of England. And he adored her, but he always said sort of at a distance, because she, too, was very busy. She had a very, very crowded social life, and she, you know, she was a piece of work. She really was, and was rumored to have had an affair with the Prince of Wales, among other people. So anyway, what was horrifying to her son Winston is that as he's about to go off to war, she tells him, look, I'm going to marry again. And it was one of his friends, you know,
it's a contemporary.
Yes, George Cornwallis West, who was just 2 weeks older than he was and was also going off to the war. And she did end up marrying George. Yeah.
Let's go back even further, because I think a lot of folks may not know much about the Boer War. This is not something that we're as
not
schooled
well known.
In.
Yeah, no.
So what is it? What was it? And then we can sort of dig into what the British, what they wanted to get from this.
So just really quickly, the Boers were a group of South African settlers. They were largely Dutch, German, and Huguenot settlers that had been there for centuries. They were very religious. They were very racist. They were very independent. When the British Empire had abolished slavery in 1833, to get away from the British Empire and live as they wanted to, 2 years later, they went on, what was called the Great Trek. And so they went hundreds of miles into the interior from the Cape and established their own republics. The problem was that they found gold and they found diamonds on this land. And the man who had become the president of one of the republics said, you know, this wealth will cause our country to be soaked in blood. And he was right. It was just a few years later, in 1880, the first Boer War broke out. And then fast forward 20 years later, almost 20 years to 1899, the British still want their land. The Boers still want their independence. The British are putting troops around their republics. The Boers say, enough is enough. Stand down or be ready for war. And the British are like, great, that you just gave us our excuse to go to war.
And as you pointed out, this is the turn of the century. The British Empire, of course, there is much hubris. There is much They still control. How big was the reach of the British Empire here in 1899?
It was enormous. It was enormous. I mean, it was larger than the Roman Empire at its height. And so that was one of the problems for the British, actually, because they had all of these colonies, they were stretched very thin, constantly putting down revolts. And so they were used to colonial wars, and they expected this to be just another colonial war. Even though they had already fought the Boers and had lost 20 years earlier, they sort of forgot who they were fighting. So war breaks out in October, and they think, no big deal, it'll be over with by Christmas.
And this sort of hubris you can see that Churchill brought with him as well. I think the most dramatic point that you bring up about Churchill is not just his burning ambition, but this belief in his, really his destiny is to be here, and that he feels that he is indefeatable, and that nothing is going to kill him. Bullets literally whiz by him.
Right.
Everywhere he's gone, he has escaped injury and harm.
Right. It's extraordinary. And he put himself in the most dangerous situations. So he rode a white pony on the battlefield in British India just to get attention, just to get noticed. But one of my favorite quotes from this time is he told his mother, I don't believe the gods would create so prosaic a being as myself. So fantastic a being as myself for so prosaic an ending.
I think of that about myself so often. We need to take a break here, but coming up, we'll have more of our conversation with Candace Millard.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. I'm Amy Walter with the Cook Political Report, sitting in for Diane Rehm. I'm sitting here in the studio with Candace Millard. She is the author of a book, Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, The Making of Winston Churchill. Just want to remind everyone who's listening, you can call in with a question to 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. You can find us on Facebook, or you can send us a tweet. Candace Millard, talking about the war in South Africa, I can't help but, and I think many of our listeners can't help but think of the fact that you have two European groups, white Europeans, fighting over land and property that's not their own. Right. So talk to us a little bit about the African experience as this was going on, Native Africans who were living there, and where they fit in to all of this. And
absolutely. And that was important to me, to tell that part of the story to the extent that I could. And I go into sort of the background of Native Africans and how they came to be in this part of Africa as well. And they are pulled into this war. This is absolutely not, you know, Churchill sees this land and he thinks, oh, this beautiful land of opportunity. It would be so great for the British Empire to have. The Boers shouldn't have it. And the Boers think, no, God has given us this land, when, of course, it belonged to neither of them. Right. And there had been people who had been living there, not for thousands of years, but for millions of years. And so it's fascinating. Of course, they were pulled into this war. They were forced to participate in it, to fight in it. What happens later on is the British start some of the first concentration camps, and many, many Native Africans died in British concentration camps as well. What I found, what was really interesting to me, is I found a man named Solomon Plaikie, who was this extraordinary person who spoke half a dozen European languages, not even mentioning all the different African dialects that he spoke. He was largely self-educated. He served as a translator for a lot of native Africans who would be accused of crimes and taken to court and have no idea what was going on. He started newspapers, and he kept a diary during this time. And I found this diary. It was actually discovered like in the 70s. A man had gone into Kimberley and had asked, are there any diaries or any books or anything that were written by Native Africans during this time? And somebody came out with this manuscript that had been sort of tucked away. And it's extraordinary. It really is extraordinary to watch him watching these two groups of white men fighting over his people's land. And it's beautifully written. And what's interesting, Solomon Plaikey ended up becoming the first secretary of the ANC.
And when we also think about the aftermath of this war, and then we get into the right. apartheid era right. and such, what did things look like in the 1890s as we saw as sort of a precursor mm-hmm. for what life was going to look like for South Africans?
So the Boers are what then later become the Afrikaners. Right. And they developed the language Afrikaans. As I said, they were deeply racist. Part of the reason that they developed the republics is because England had abolished slavery. And Churchill was very well aware of that. In fact, his father had gone to South Africa only a few years before and had written letters back to be published in newspapers excoriating the Boers for their treatment of Native Africans. And he was very proud of that. And he was very much aware of the treatment Native Africans fell under during the Boers. And obviously that carries through, unfortunately, for many, many years. And England promised Native Africans that things would get better after the war was won. And of course, they didn't for a long, long time. It took us a long time to get to Nelson Mandela.
Let's take us back now to Winston Churchill getting to South Africa. He's anxious to start reporting. He wants to get on the front lines.
Yeah.
He ends up on a train.
Right.
And the train is attacked. Can
right.
you walk us through that
day? So it's really this extraordinary event. So again, he's 24 years old. He's a correspondent. He's not even a member of the military. He's one of the few civilians on this train. And these armored trains are notoriously easy targets for the Boers. So the Boers are watching, and they're this very, very skilled, very invisible enemy. So they're fighting a totally different kind of war than the British are used to. So they're just watching this train go by. And you know what? They know it's going to go this way, and then it's going to come right back on the same tracks. So they watch it go by. They go to the bottom of a hill. They pile stones on the tracks, and they wait at the top of the hill for the train to come. As soon as the train comes, they start firing on it. The train does exactly what they want it to do, which is go as fast as it can to get away from them. It goes to the bottom of the hill. It hits these stones, and it catapults off the track. So the first two cars go flying. Men are killed. Men are horribly wounded. And the engine is still on the tracks, but it's stuck behind one of the cars that's sort of half on, half off. And Winston Churchill, who, again, is one of the few civilians on the train, he immediately jumps up and takes charge of the defense. And he starts running back and forth, dodging bullets, shells exploding everywhere, shouting orders. And what's more extraordinary is that everybody listens to him. I mean, there are many legitimate soldiers uniformed with their commander right there, commander who is a friend of Churchill's and who had invited him along, who is also like, yep, Winston, tell us what to do. How can we support you? And he gets it done. And he gets the train off the tracks. He goes back to help some other people. But the train gets off. Everybody who makes it out alive, every single person, credits Winston Churchill's bravery and resourcefulness for saving their lives.
And how did you find this source material? Because the book has such rich detail. Tell us a little bit about the research that you did and any trips you took to South Africa to get some of the... Were you on those train? Are those train tracks still there? Could you picture what it would feel like to be on that trip?
In fact, that's one of the reasons, to be honest, that I wanted to do the story, because I got to go to South Africa. So obviously I did a lot of research in England. I went to Cambridge, where the Churchill Archives are. I went to the National Army Museum, the Kew Archives, Blenheim Palace. And then I spent quite a bit of time in South Africa. And it's extraordinary. I went to exactly where he was captured. I went to Pretoria, to the same building that was his POW camp. In fact, it's incredible. It's now a public library. But on the wall, this was an officer's prison. And so these men were incredibly skilled cartographers. So on the wall, they had drawn a map of South Africa, carefully charting the war. And that's still there. In the room where Churchill was kept is a trap door in the floor. And I stood there, and they had at one point thought about digging their way out, tunneling under the road. And you can see where they quickly hit water and stuff. But I went to where he hid in this coal mine shaft for 3 days. I went into Mozambique, which was then Portuguese East Africa, where he finally came to freedom. So it was just an incredible experience.
I also want to talk a little bit about, he gets captured though, after this incident on the train.
Right.
He has great bravery, but ultimately he's captured and pulled, as you point out, he's taken into a POW camp, but sent with the officers. But, for those who have an image of what a dark, terrible place this camp may be, life wasn't that terrible if you were an officer. Your servants were allowed to come with you. You could get newspapers. You'd get a shave. So talk about what life was like for Winston Churchill in this camp or prison.
So the Boers had sort of a chip on their shoulder. They thought that the British, and it was true, that the British thought that they were uncouth and uncivilized. And so it was important to them to show the British that they were, in fact, very civilized as they were. And so they allowed these officers incredible leeway. As you say, I mean, Churchill had a guy come in and give him a haircut and a shave. They were able to order a suit and all get newspapers and sort of follow the war. It was a lot of leeway. But still, to Winston Churchill, it's interesting because he said that he hated every second of his captivity more than he had ever hated any other period in his whole life. He couldn't bear the thought of being a captive, of being a prisoner. And it shaped him. Later on, he became Home Secretary. And it was really important to him that prisoners were treated with compassion. Mm-hmm. He said, whatever they've done, how horrible, they're still humans, and they deserve books, and they deserve time outside, and they deserve a chance to exercise. So it really shaped him and left a strong impression on him for the rest of his life.
We've gotten a couple of emails and from folks asking, about the similarities between Winston Churchill and somebody else you've written a lot about, Teddy Roosevelt. These larger than life characters who take on these adventures to sort of prove themselves. So, can you talk to us about that, the similarities and differences between these two figures?
I absolutely agree. In fact, the whole time I was researching it, I kept thinking how much he reminded me of Theodore Roosevelt. And, they actually knew each other. They met at one point, and they didn't like each other. And I think it's because they were so much alike. No, they were both incredibly ambitious, incredibly arrogant, incredibly well-read, amazing writers. I mean, the similarity goes on and on. In fact, I always laugh about Winston Churchill, and the same was said about Roosevelt. Again and again, at this time in his life, people would say, I can't stand that kid. He's going to be prime minister one day, but I cannot stand him.
He's here at this POW camp. He's plotting every minute he can to get out. He's working with a couple of other officers who are also trying to escape, but they don't want to include him in their plans, right?
Not at all. Well, and so being Winston Churchill, his plan is not just to quietly escape. No, he's going to sort of take over the whole prison, and then he's also going to take over the prison where the soldiers are staying, and then they're going to take over all of Pretoria, and then they're going to kidnap the president, and they're going to end the war. And so he's telling everybody, and they're just like, oh, just get away from me. And so he overhears Almer Holden, who is the guy who invited him to be on the armor train, and this guy, Brocky. And Brocky is very strong and very savvy. And he speaks Zulu and he speaks Afrikaans. And he's been in South Africa for a long time and he knows his way around. And Churchill finds out that they have this quiet little plan. And he's like, look, I want to be a part of it. And Holden feels bad because, like, I did invite him on. And Brocky's like, no way. He's going to tell everybody. He's not strong enough. It's me a disaster. But Holden says, okay, Churchill, I'll leave it up to you. We don't want you to come, but it's your decision. Churchill says, I'm coming.
He does come, but tell us a little bit about that. It didn't exactly go along according to plan, right?
Yes, no, it didn't. So what it was is there's a fence that surrounded the yard of this prison. There are armed guards patrolling at all
And you can still
times.
See that today? Like,
yeah,
did you
yeah,
feel
yeah.
like when you were sitting at
yeah,
what's now a library,
can, yeah,
you could
right.
imagine
it's
what it would
surreal,
look like.
Surreal, but you could. You absolutely could. And what they discovered is that, so they had electric lights, newly had electric lights on that came on at night, but there was one corner that remained dark. Mm. And so they said, look, if a guard is looking in the wrong way, you can quickly get out. And there was a latrine that was right by that you could hide in and quickly get out. But so they chose their night, and they all kind of tried, and it didn't work. And Churchill said, I'm just going to go over and take a look. And they're like, nothing's going to happen. Let's just go in and have dinner, and then we'll try again after dinner. So Holden and Brocky go inside, but Churchill sees his chance, and he gets out. He climbs over. But now the problem is, so he's hiding in these bushes right outside, waiting for the other guys who know the plan, who have the food, the map, the compass, weapon. He has nothing. He doesn't speak the language. He doesn't know his way around. And so he waits for them for almost an hour. But they can't get out. So he's trapped.
So he's trapped there with a bar of chocolate.
Right.
And what else?
Biscuit,
is that it?
Crumbling in his pocket, a few pounds, and that's it.
And that's it.
By himself.
To go for
almost
300 miles
of enemy territory. Right.
I'm Amy Walter. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email to DR Show. You can at drshow@wamu.org. You can find us on Facebook. You can send us a tweet. An email here from Mark in Kansas.
Oh.
We're going to go for. Is this one of somebody in your life?
I don't know.
I don't know. This could be. You are from Kansas City, right?
I am from Kansas City.
This comes at the end of the book, but there is another famous 20th century figure that makes a brief appearance in your book, and that is Mahatma Gandhi.
Right. Right.
Which, again, you can't imagine, right? You have Teddy Roosevelt, Gandhi, and Churchill all at the same time. So, how does he figure into this? He said he was. He later became a great thorn in Churchill's side, but he led an ambulance service who put themselves in harm's way. Mm-hmm. Did Churchill ever mention this group, or did they have any run-ins early on?
Right. So Gandhi had been living in South Africa for a long time. So he was this failed lawyer, and he went to South Africa to start again. And he saw, all this oppression going on that was also directed toward the Indian population. And so he started to organize, and he found that he, too, was this born leader and an incredible organizer. Always sort of clashing with the Boers. So when the Boer War breaks out, he says he wants to help the British Empire, because he wants to prove the British Empire that we deserve rights. Indians do as well. And so what he did is he put together a group of stretcher bearers. But it's astonishing. He ends up on the same battlefield as a stretcher bearer that Churchill then later is fighting on. I mean, and he's not the only. I mean, Rudyard Kipling was also there. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was also there. I mean, it's history. And you always get these incredible, bizarre intersections.
Well, we're at a time, we're at the turn of the 20th century. We know what's now in hindsight, we know it's about to come.
Right.
But what is the lessons that you were able to, thanks to your research and being able to know what's to come. What did we learn from Churchill's experience, the Boer War, that would enlighten us to what we could expect from the 20th century, both in the way that the country saw itself as well as the sort of the innovations in military? Before we have to take a little bit of a break so you can think about that.
Great.
When we come back, we'll take your calls and questions for Candace Millard. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Amy Walter with the Cook Political Report, sitting in for Diane Rehm. I'm joined in the studio today with Candace Millard. She's the author of the new book, Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape and the Making of Winston Churchill. When we left off, Candace, we were talking about what the 1899 was like and what this experience would tell us as we moved into the 20th century, an era, of course, marked by a great deal of strife and war.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what most of the largest lesson that comes out of this war is the danger of arrogance. You know, it is as dangerous as it is ubiquitous. So the British come in thinking that this is going to be no problem. They nickname their commander-in-chief the steamroller. They quickly take care of it. And instead, they find themselves losing again and again and again. And what's interesting about the Boer War, it's really the beginning of modern warfare. So the British come in. They've only recently given up their red coats and sort of reluctantly, grumpily taken on khakis, but they're still fighting in these precise formations, just served up for slaughter. And slowly, slowly, after losing many wars, many lives, they start to figure it out and they start to change. And so the British Army going into the Boer War is completely different from the one coming out, and it prepares them for World War
One. That's what I was going to say. And then
it does.
The measures that you took there, both in the weapons as well as in the strategy.
Style of fight.
Yeah,
right. Exactly.
So let's get back to Winston Churchill. He climbs over the fence.
Right.
His comrades don't join him. He's alone with basically nothing, trying to figure out how to get across the country. Is there any, at this moment in time, is this very self-confident young man having any doubts about whether he'll succeed?
It's very, very interesting psychologically to watch the changes in him, because he starts out thinking, I'm absolutely going to be captured immediately, but what choice do I have? I can't go back in. I'll be shot. I've got to go forward, so I may as well just see what happens. And so as he goes farther and farther through the city, and then he's into the countryside and he's not being caught, and he's sort of loving his freedom. He's exhilarated. He's excited. He jumps on a train and he hides and he falls asleep. And then he wakes up and he realizes, what has happened? I'm in huge trouble and I've got nowhere to turn and I'm absolutely alone. And he goes through the next, you know, as he travels and gets deeper and deeper, knowing, you know, the Boers are humiliated and enraged and they're searching for him. And if they find him, there's a very real risk that they will kill him. And so he keeps sort of going back between incredible confidence, I'll figure out a way, I'm very resourceful, to despair. And at one point, and Churchill was not a religious man, but at one point he breaks down and prays for guidance. And, you know, it's a connection that we can feel. You know, you take this man who's so famous, he's almost mythical, and you realize your shared humanity.
There is also a point at which he has to count on other people to get him through. And this, again, somebody who's been so self-reliant, I can do this all myself. Mm-hmm. He ends up knocking on the door. He's sort of desperate.
Right.
And he ends up in a coal mining town. And Can you walk us through where he was on his journey there and what that led to?
So this is another aspect of Churchill's life, which is just incredible luck. I mean, it's just extraordinary. So most British citizens who were living in South Africa had been forced out when the war started. Only if very few were kept, and it was only if they were essential to and the Boers needed them in some way. So he's alone, and he sees some fires glowing in the distance. And at first, he thinks it's an African village, and he thinks maybe I can find help there because they hate the Boers even more than we do. And so he gets closer, and when he gets close enough, he realizes this isn't an African village. This is a colliery. And but he's so desperate at this point, he just thinks, I'm going to take a chance. And he knocks on a door, and he makes up the story. This guy answers the door, and he makes up the story. Look, I'm a Boer. I fell off this train. I hurt my shoulder. Can you help me? And as he's sort of amazed at himself, because this is sort of coming out fully formed, this lie that he just thought up, and he realizes, I don't speak Dutch. I don't speak Afrikaans. Right. I can't pull this off. So this guy just listens to him, says, I think you should come inside, takes him to this room, and puts a gun on the table between them and turns around and locks the door. And Churchill's thinking, you know, this is not looking good for me. And instead, the man turns around, puts out his hand, shakes Churchill's hand and said, I'm English. I'm going to help you. I'll get you out of here. And he said he felt like a drowning man who had just been saved.
I mean, it's really, it was literally just
incredible luck.
Nothing about that.
There's no skill there.
The English who were still there, feeling a sense of camaraderie, they wanted to help one of their countrymen there. But tell us, too, that there is this manhunt for Churchill, which we know who he is now. But back then, he was a 24-year-old reporter, yes, with a famous last name. But the Boers were actually doing quite well in the war. They're having great success. And yet they were printing out thousands and thousands of copies, you know, wanted posters of this man.
Right.
Why did it matter to them that one guy escaped?
It mattered a lot. They were thrilled to capture the son of a lord. Again, he sort of symbolized everything that they hate about the British Empire. And now he's their prisoner. And then he escapes. And he's very cheeky. You know, he left a letter behind that said, you know, thank you for your hospitality. I'm so sorry I couldn't be here to thank you in person. You know, you'll have to. And they hate him. And it's astonishing because all these first-hand accounts of the people who were left in the prison after Churchill escaped talked about all of a sudden everything shut down. And all those privileges they had had were taken away. Every single house is searched in Pretoria. And they said that it seemed like they had almost forgotten that they were fighting a war. So determined were they to find this young man.
And there then was great risk in for the English folks who took him in.
Right.
And they went to extraordinary measures to hide him, including putting him in a mine shaft, which sounded miserable.
And it was miserable. No, it was incredibly miserable. And Churchill was just desperate. So they take him down deep into the ground where it's dark, it's dank. Strangely, they had been using donkeys to help pull out the coal. And so it smells terrible. And they try to put him into an area that has a little bit of ventilation. But he's stuck down there. And the first night they give him a mattress and some candles and things. And he wakes up the next day and sort of everything's gone, the food, the candles. And he realizes, oh, it's the rats. There's a huge population of white rats that have been thriving down there. And every night, as soon as he puts out his candles, they're all over him, you know, running around.
I want to just imagine that for a minute, everybody, lying in a bed of rats. I want to take a call from Don from Zionsville, Indiana. Don, thank you so much for calling into the Diane Rehm Show.
It's an honor, Ms. Millarant, to speak with you. As a young man, my wife and I got a job before children. We call it our BC time in London with Ball State University, the Ball family here in Indiana, in Muncie. And we served the university. So we got to take day trips, and we took a tour to Bladen Church, to his burial site.
Yes,
Prime Minister Churchill's burial site. We went to, of course, Blenheim, to his cemetery gravesite. And I know Jenny, historically, his mom, as you certainly mentioned, from Philadelphia, I believe. And this is, of course, much later in time, past much past the Boer War. But did Winston Churchill love to travel in America? How much did he claim his Americanism? I know that he gave, FDR gave him an American passport during World War II, and I've read his exploits with President Roosevelt in the North African campaign. And I know his Fulton, Missouri speech, his Iron Curtain speech. So I just kind of wanted to know about how much Americanism he claimed. And I know his painting for some of his depression. And a follow-up question, was it ever, because I know he drank so much, his stories about drinking in Parliament during the day and whatnot, was it ever proven like he was an alcoholic? And I'll just take your questions off air. Thank you so much, and I'll buy your book.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. Those are great questions. Yes, he. It's funny because I look at Churchill and I think how much of him seems American to me, that sort of unbridled ambition, you know, which was sort of unheard of and very uncool, especially within the aristocracy and within the military, the British military at that time. And obviously, you know, there was a special relationship that came out of his connection with the United States. And I think he did feel his Americanism. He was he adored his mother. And that was just it was absolutely a part of who he was. As far as his drinking, you know, I don't think that he was an alcoholic. He did absolutely enjoy. In fact, he began his sort of love affair with whiskey even before this war, and his love affair with cigars even before that. So it was a sort of a part of who he was. But, you know, he was such a determined guy who was always on. And I don't think he was ever really blunted then by the effects of alcohol.
So here he is down in the mine shaft. He was trying to smoke some cigars, but miserable.
Yeah.
And even his friends who were hiding him out knew that he couldn't stay down there for much longer.
Right.
So
took pity on him.
Yeah. So how does he go from the mine shaft to freedom?
So they finally bring him up. They would take him up to walk for a little bit when he was hiding in the mine shaft. And finally, they're like, "Look, I think he's going to snap if we leave him down there." So they hid him in a room in this man John Howard's house, and he was sort of hiding back there. And they're trying to figure out how are we going to get him out? How are we going to get him out? And then they realize that this guy Burnham has a store, and he often has dealings with Portuguese East Africa, where he has to send wool into. And they decide we're going to hide him in one of these wool cars. And so they sort of carve out a little area. It was just packed with wool. And one night they slip him in. And thank God, Burnham decides at the last minute, you know what, I should probably ride with him. And he's absolutely essential. There's no question Churchill would have been caught at stop after stop because he has to make all these stops along the way. And again, the Boers are searching for him everywhere, and it's war, and so they're checking cars all the time. You can't just get through, and so Burnham is constantly bribing people along the way. Look, you know what? This is really important. I've got to get there quickly. Could you just pass my stuff through without inspecting it? And again, you know, incredible luck by the skin of his teeth, he gets out.
Tell us though, when he does get out, he makes it to Portuguese East Africa.
Right.
But how does he actually get to freedom once he makes it there?
So what he does is he, as soon as the train pulls in, he's still in danger. I mean, there are Boers all over the city who could grab him. So Burnham is waiting for him. And he just kind of looks at him. And the idea is just follow me, don't say a word. And so he follows him through the streets and of what's now Maputo. And they get to where there's a British consulate. And he sees it across the street, and he marches across the street, and he opens the door, and he goes up to the secretary, and he said, and he demands to see the consul general. And the secretary looks at this filthy young man, because he's covered in coal dust, no idea who he is, and says, you know, sneeringly, if you want an appointment, you can come back tomorrow. And he's furious, and he stands back, and he starts shouting who he is. The window flies open, and the consul general looks down. He comes running down, and he asks him, what's your name? And it's Winston Churchill. And then, I mean, he's a national hero after that.
I'm Amy Walter. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to take another caller here, Pat from Ann Arbor. Pat, thank you for calling in.
Hi. Yeah, I was just, you know, Churchill's just kind of a man about town as far as world events go. You know, what experience in the Boer War, you know, 20 years later, he'd be dictating the terms of the Anglo-Irish Treaty. And I know the Irish took the pages from the Boers and how that impacted British tactics militarily and politically going forward. Could you just comment on that? I'll just get off the phone and listen to your answer.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's really fascinating. So what drew me to this story is to try to figure out how you get somebody like Winston Churchill. How do you create this person who, you know, lives 90 years, but among the most sort of crowded and complex years imaginable? There's so much happening in his life, and he becomes one of the most famous human beings in history. So how do you get there? And it's fascinating what happens to him. This is not only a launching pad for his political career. So he runs for Parliament before, loses. Now he's a national hero. He wins. He's off. But it helps cement all of these things that he sort of knew about himself. He believed he was special. He was extraordinary. He was destined for greatness. But here he proves it, you know, again and again and again. He does these things that are absolutely audacious, and he does them alone. And so all of these things that he uses later on throughout his life that we think of uniquely Churchill come out of this experience, you know, his ingenuity, his agility, his determination, his grit, all of these things, I think, help to shape the Winston Churchill we think of throughout his life.
As he gets out of South Africa, he comes back to England, and you said he's instantly a hero, right? And he's instantly recognized. How long between the time he actually landed back in England did he win election?
Just a matter of months. So he actually came to the United States and went on a speaking tour. And there was actually a lot he didn't appreciate it, because there are a lot of people who supported the Boers in the United States at that time and kind of felt some sort of, oh, you know, they're pioneers, they're independent, they, you know, wasn't that long ago that we had been trying to shake off the British Empire. And so anyway, and then he goes back to England, and he very quickly runs for Parliament again and wins. And he says in a letter to the Prime Minister Salisbury at the time, he says, there's no doubt that this comes out of my popularity from the war in South Africa.
And of course, there would be so much more to come.
So much more to the story.
Candace Millard, thank you so much for joining us. Her book, Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, The Making of Winston Churchill. I'm Amy Walter with the Cook Political Report, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Baker, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Boti, Danielle Knight, Erica R. Hendry, Allison Brody, and Gracie McKenzie. The engineer is Alex Strawinskas. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.